Welcome to our little synagogue. Little synagogue in the kitchen. We, when we were in St. Thomas, we visited a synagogue. It was really cool. When you walked in, there was sand all over the floor. And the reason why they had sand
not
on the floor...
Not because it's in St. Thomas. Like, they not were, because it was on the beach. Synagogues have sand on the ground.
The reason why they had the sand on the ground is because of the level of oppression. There was times in history where the Jews had to be quiet in their worship, so they would put sand on the floor so people couldn't hear them, like, engaging in worship service. So it just reminded me of that, just being in this small space in the kitchen made me think of that. But we wanted to take some time this Hanukkah to talk about the Maccabees, because some of the earliest references to Hanukkah is in the book of Maccabees, which is not in the Protestant Bible. So a lot of times Mom will mention books that are associated with the Bible, but they're not canonized. So there's the book of Maccabees, which their place in history took place between the Tanakh and the Renewed Covenant. So there's a span of several hundred centuries, or not hundred centuries, several centuries between those two books that they call the Silent Years. And if you insert the book of Maccabees, that's where it would be time-wise. So, because some
silent
of the
years, meaning there's kind of a gap. So once you go through all the Old Testament, Malachi, all the prophets, there's a gap of time before Yeshua shows up on the scene. So they call that the silent years because there's not a lot written in that time, or at least what got canonized, which means approved. So several different churches or organizations will approve what Bible books are in our Bible. I don't want us to... What we're not doing is saying that these books that are not canonized, we approve them. Like, we're not saying as kingdom heirs they should be approved. There's not enough... We don't have enough knowledge and cross-referencing to recognize why they weren't or are. But what I do know, this is what I do know. So, for example, the Book of the Maccabees is in the Catholic Church, in the Catholic Bible. They did canonize it, but the Protestants did not. So the point is that there is a lot of scripture out there, especially when the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, then more information came out later after the church decided to canonize things, right? So different sections of religion will say yay or nay, and I'm not here to say I agree or disagree, but what I am interested in is that the scripture that we have now is from the Protestant movement, essentially, because there are books that are not canonized by that movement that I would use as a resource. So I'm not here to say the Maccabees should be canonized and it's completely in alignment with all of the scriptures. There's a reason why it wasn't. I don't know what that reason was, but what I do know is that it is a resource. It's like Enoch. We know Enoch is in the Bible.
Yeah.
So, but there's only like a paragraph about Enoch. It's a kind of powerful paragraph. He was with God and then he was no more. He didn't die. So we have an example of somebody who never died. And the way he walked, I would want to learn how he walked. Well, guess what? There's three books of Enoch. So you can learn how to walk like Enoch because of these books, but a lot of the church will not canonize it because there are things that are in Enoch that kind of contradict some of the Renewed Covenant, and for that reason, then they take it out. And we're not scholars to say yes or no, but I'm not afraid. I'm not one to be like, that is, you know, if it's not canonized, then it just is not for, but you have to have the proper context when you're reading these things as a resource and not necessarily, I guess the question is, the theology is, it are those Yahweh breathed scripture? That's the part that gets a little bit difficult because they're all authors. I mean, at the end of the day, Moshe read, I mean, Moshe wrote the scriptures, but we believe that Yahweh orchestrated and said that they were to be ordained scripture. But like, who decided that? Scholars are the ones that ultimately make that decision. And so there's just kind of some, anyways, I just wanted to make that clear. Like, we're not saying that the Maccabees should be in the scripture or not, but what we are saying is that it's a huge resource and it's a huge story that we have access to as a reference to be able to line our ideals from, but we're not necessarily saying that it's Yahweh breathed scripture and anyways. Just, yeah.
So with that being said, we have a direct connection to this family, right? Because there are Hebrew ancestors and there's values and traditions that we want to teach about, especially during Hanukkah, so that we can understand who we are and kind of the nature of our DNA across history. So one of the reasons why I love this is because it unlocks, you know how we sometimes talk about, or we have talked about how in Christianity there's this general sense that you should be sweet and nice and don't make any waves and, you know, you don't want to like rub anybody the wrong way, right? It turns into this thing where you just turn into a doormat. Right, but when you look at the history of the, or you compromise,
you're taught not to have convictions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when you start to learn about our ancestors, the Maccabees, and how they kind of, okay,
yep,
how they kind of shaped
flipping tables over here,
they shaped a lot of what Hanukkah is and how we celebrate it. It really flies in the face of all that. And the reason why I love this is because it conveys a side of our history where it's like you should have a capacity for violence. Like, and we were going to do archery and talk about this because there's an expectation as part of how this family operated that there was an expectation that you're not just somebody who has faith, but you're somebody who is capable or has the capacity to have violence to maintain what's been dedicated to Yahweh, right? Like you will physically defend it, right, with your capacity for violence. And so what's really cool about the Maccabees, I just kind of want to break down some basic information for the family to go and launch off of and begin to learn more about it on your own. But the one of the most amazing things is that when you talk about the Maccabees, it was a mother and a father and their seven sons. That's who we're talking about. The mother is unnamed in the books of the Maccabees. We don't know what her name is. The father's name was Mattathias, and then you had Judas Maccabee, the oldest of seven brothers, and you can find out what the seven brothers' names were, or he was one of seven. Judah was known as the hammer of the Jews, because that was his reputation. People knew him as the hammer of the Jews because of his capacity for violence. But really the entire family operated that way. And I think it's important that it was a mother and a father and a family. It was a family affair to be able to be violent in the name of Yahweh, which just sounds crazy, right? Now
he says, take the kingdom by violence, right? There's an aspect of kingdom violence and force.
So the context of the Maccabees, so we know who the family is, we know kind of their nature, the context of the time that they lived in, they were being oppressed by a Roman Empire, and the king that was in power at the time, his name was Antiochus Epiphanes. I don't know if I'm saying that right. But he basically banned any observance of Jewish holidays and feasts or Jewish worship. He banned all of it. He basically outlawed it. He arrested the whole Maccabee family because they were engaging in these things. And he actually tried to force feed them swine. So not only did he ban their way of life and the way that they walk, right? Covenant life, everything we've been learning about and been engaging in, he banned all that, arrested them. But not only that, he really tried to desecrate their way of life by making them eat swine.
Now, okay. Just to put it in, I want to make sure that we're putting, the reason why we're saying that he banned Jewish worship is because that was the context at that time. So when Yeshua shows up on the scene, it was not Gentile and Jew just because he showed up on the scene. It was already happening because the scattering of the tribes had already happened. So we're talking post, which we have not taught on, but the Babylonian and all of that scattering, the idolatry worship and all of the tribes that we've been learning that were all in one accord, eventually the kingdom splits. So being able to fast forward, just so you guys kind of have the span, you've got Judah that stayed loyal along with half the Levites and Benjamin. The other tribes split from the Hebraic way of living, fell into paganism, and scattered. So there, so at this point that he's talking about, that family, is Israel, had already been separated. Now you'll understand when Yeshua steps on the scene, he said, I came for the lost sheep, or I came for those that are scattered. He's talking about his people. Yeah. Now he's not talking about the church and the Gentiles while they're over there. He's talking about what was once together has scattered, and I'm here to bring it back together. And we have a completely different context because we've separated the Bible between Jew and Gentile when it's really between the scattered ones along with obviously Gentiles that are pagan that can come into the family, but not come into Judaism, come into Hebrew. So anyways, they're already separated. So when Antioch comes in and is banning, to me, he's banning Hebraic worship. It's just the context at that time, it had already become a Jewish worship because they were the only ones that stayed loyal. So that's why you have the Maccabees who were a part of the tribe of Judah because they were Jews. But that doesn't mean that it has anything to do with Jew and Gentile, if that makes sense. It's just that's the context of what had already happened.
Now, what's crazy is the Maccabees, right, they embody leadership and legacy because they were nine people that basically led a revolution against the whole Seleucid Empire, which was the people in power at the time that were banning them, arresting them. They tortured them. Tried to force feed them pig, right, which we all know is an issue. The amazing thing is that, and this, to me, this just paints a perfect picture of how the family is intertwined into this whole thing. So the mother who's unnamed, right, a lot of the writings talk about how she had the reasoning of a woman but the courage of a man. So women were just as a part of the violent rebellion as the men were. And in fact, it was the mother who told her husband and her sons when they were arrested, tortured, force-fed pig, that they should fight to the death to rebel against what was being forced on them. Mm-hmm. Now think about that. How many mothers, generally speaking...
Eat it. He knows your heart.
Right.
Yeah.
He knows her heart. That's good. But generally speaking, right, a mother is going to try to keep her family from danger.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This mother said, I would encourage you men to refuse to obey what is being forced on you. And in fact, it led to the martyrdom of the entire family. So the entire family all died for the sake of religious freedom. That's the extent they took it to. And so you can begin to understand, like, when we celebrate Hanukkah and the Feast of Dedication, that's where that name comes from, is that the Maccabees essentially led the rebellion against this entire Roman Empire that was in power at the time.
And won.
And they won. So they reclaimed the temple, which was taken over by this Roman Empire, desecrated. They would bring pigs and put pigs on the altar. I mean, just imagine the disrespect and desecration of people's way of life and honoring Yahweh, and they just totally destroyed that, right? And they did it inside the temple. So this family led the rebellion to not only reclaim the temple, but they rededicated it. So they reclaimed it and they rededicated it. So there's a lot of things in your life, right? We're going through a process of, as a family today, of reclaiming the original intent, yeah. But then there's also rededicating it. So you're
giving it back.
You're washing it of that desecration. Mm-hmm. Right? So I think it's powerful because, I mean, it's hard to compare our lives now to that time period and the way things were. But at the same time, there's a lot of similarities in the things that we face today, the criticism. You know, there is modern day persecution of the Jews. We're starting to kind of see a little bit of those, the beginnings of those things rising up across our country today. We see it globally, the anti-Semitism, the heightened threats against synagogues and Jewish worship and all those type of things. And so what I think is amazing in honoring this history and tradition that we have is that we are in a process of learning more and more of who we are, right? So take this morning as part of our family's history and begin to think of how would you operate in these type of situations, right? When the persecution comes to your door, when the oppression comes to your door, when people are criticizing or demanding that you operate a certain way, or they're trying to desecrate or dishonor the things that you honor, right? How is it that we can operate, or what can we learn from the Maccabees who essentially reclaimed and rededicated what we're celebrating right now, right? They're the ones that kept the fire burning and making sure it didn't go out because they were willing to lay their lives down over it. And it wasn't just a certain part of the family who had a tendency towards violence. It was the entire family. Right. So when we, part of the heart of doing archery was everybody was out there learning archery, and Derek's going to speak to some of those things. But it's not limited to like the women and children are going to stay inside and the men are going to go do this. How awesome that that's part of our Hebrew identity, that it's everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody's cooking and cleaning. Everybody's shooting a bow. Everybody's doing everything.
Yeah.
Right. Everybody was willing to lay their life down and be martyred to not tolerate the dishonor and the desecration of their way of life.
Yeah.
Right? When we talk about being followers of the way, this is included in that. When you're a follower of the way, you don't tolerate the dishonor or the desecration, right? Doesn't mean you're going out and conquering and telling everybody this is how they're going to do it, right? We kind of talked about that. We're not imposing our way of life on other people. But we're not going to tolerate other people imposing what they say on our way of life, right? Does that make sense? This is how our ancestors were. They were rebels. They were small, right? They were fighting an entire Roman Empire, and they were a small group of people. So they had to use guerrilla warfare, ambushes, and they used it in such a successful manner that they reclaimed the temple. Right? And they were small. Which just speaks to just the general pattern we see in scripture, that it's not the masses that are gonna dictate, you know, our way of life. It's not the masses that have the truth of the scripture. I mean, you see the remnant pattern throughout scripture, and you see it with the Maccabees as well. And It's encouraging to me to learn about this, because in this path that we've been on, to me, it has felt very contrarian, very like, you know, they were rebels, right? They were rebellious, not against Yahweh,
right?
But they were rebellious against the norm that tries to shape you in a certain way. That's what they were rebelling against, and they were very successful at it. And so they were kind of characterized by being contrary to the norm, which is just interesting, because the system we came out of, we weren't contrary to anything.
Yes.
Yeah.
We were just a part of the mass group of religion and Christianity, whereas now a lot of what we're seeing and what we're experiencing is because we are contrary to the norm. Right? So there's just elements of what I would just call religious commitment, not in the way we normally talk about it, in a negative way, but they had a level of commitment to where they were willing to die over it, right? And I can honestly say that's kind of how I think about it. If I think about it that way, nobody's scrutiny or criticism is going to change how I try to pursue the way we're supposed to walk, or force me to conform, or force me to compromise to whatever the world is trying to push on us, mm-hmm. right? I'm just not going to do it. Mm-hmm. And it makes me think of, there's one story that I've shared here and there, but one of the Maccabees, they were being confronted by a king, two of the brothers.
Wait, hold on. Let me just... We're going to have a Selah moment before he says this, because... Well, just now receive what he's about to say.
So two of the brothers were being confronted by a king in the opposition, and one brother sensed that the other brother was beginning to compromise, and he killed him on the spot. One brother killed the other brother, and what he said was, it would be better for me to kill you than for you to compromise.
Yes.
I mean, that's the level of commitment.
See, he was... Like, when it feels like I'm stabbing you, it's because it would be better for me to kill you than to let you compromise.
But think about that. It wasn't... It was... I can somewhat understand the heart of the brother who killed the other brother, because he was saving... He was saving him from compromising. And the way he chose to do it was to take his life so he would not compromise. I mean, that's the level of commitment that they had. And so I think it's important for us to understand and to study and understand who the Maccabees were, because there is a lot of that DNA and tradition and the way that they operated that I feel like we do carry in this family. Like, we are called to that level of commitment and dedication.
Yeah.
Right, we're called to that level of pursuing to reclaim what Yahweh has for us and what we're supposed to honor, and then rededicate it and safeguard it with our lives. That is, Yahweh does honor that, and it's not something that we need to apologize for. Right, we don't need to apologize that Yahweh is raising us to be a family that can be farmers, and, you know, so to speak, and we can be in the kitchen and we can do all those things, but we're also equally capable of defending what it is that Yahweh tells us to honor, mm-hmm. right? And we don't need to apologize for that, right?
Yeah.
So I just want to read something. This is kind of a statement I put together just for our family to kind of capture this DNA, and I can send this to everybody on Voxer, but as kingdom heirs, we honor and uphold the rich heritage of our ancestors, the Maccabees, by fostering a deep commitment to our Hebrew faith, actively preserving our cultural traditions, and empowering our community through education and leadership, and celebrating our history of resilience and resistance against oppression. Mm-hmm. So that, I want you guys to take that statement, and I'll put it out there, and really begin to own that, because that is part of our DNA. And that is the history going back as far as it's recorded of why we celebrate Hanukkah. So it's not just a nice, you know, we'll light the menorah, like we're just lighting a
it
candle.
It has nothing to do with a replacement of Christmas.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
It has nothing to do with his birth. This is prior to, it doesn't have anything to do with anything. It just happens to be the timing that the revolt happened and the rededication of the temple happened was on the Hebrew calendar. And so that's why it's celebrated during that 8 days, is honoring that time that they dedicated the temple. Because, you know, now that is folklore, or part of the story is that once they rededicated, the miracle of Hanukkah was that they only had so many supplies to be able to reestablish it. I mean, just think about what I'm trying to think of, like, an example. Like, if this was the synagogue or the temple, and, you know, it's one thing to kind of, like, come against us like on social media. But if somebody came in and invaded the home and like started roasting a pig in my kitchen, you're going to get a different side of me than just being quiet on social media. Right. Yeah. So there's like this, but then if that happened and the desecration and people started putting like mockery and there was like pig portraits and, you know, doing things that are just, you know, like saying, you know, you'd have to take all your supplies to clean it out and then be able to rededicate it, because think about the temple. All that stuff is in the temple. So like if the Roman Empire came in and took the, I don't know exactly what happened, but if they took the lampstand and just broke it in half, they were basically saying Yeshua is like done for. They'd have to clean all that out and then bring all of those elements and all those details. It's not like they just rededicated a space and said, okay, now we won. They had to reestablish the structure of essentially the tabernacle and put those things back in place. So part of it was that they didn't have the resources to do that. So it was a miracle that they had oil that would last through the whole 8 days, because they didn't have the priesthood and all of that established to be able to keep, you know, when you think about like the show bread, every week it was new bread. Well, they've been under attack for, you know, for this whole time. So it's like, well, now who's going to make the bread? So they had to work on it. So anyways, the Hanukkah miracle is that the oil, once they had placed it, it just burned for 8 days, and the light continued in order for them to be able to do the work so they could see and all that kind of stuff. So
we're experiencing part of their legacy now, right? This whole time we've been together, we're experiencing part of that legacy. And the legacy required them to have leadership. Like, this legacy is based on their leadership, and their leadership was based on their conviction. So bringing it back to our family now, if we want to continue to leave the legacy, we have to have leadership. We have to be leaders, right? There is a way that we raise everyone here that you can stand on your own two feet and articulate your conviction in order to perpetuate the legacy.
Yeah.
Right? So how important is it for us to know what our convictions are, to be able to articulate those convictions and be so passionate about it that we're willing to lay our lives down for it and make sure that we're securing that legacy for the next generation, right? If they couldn't articulate their convictions, they wouldn't have been leaders to lead a revolt, to leave us a legacy to celebrate now. So we have to be familiar with that and understand what it is when we're releasing something or teaching about the original intent. We have to embrace that like our life depends on it, or the next generation's life depends on it, because we have to be leaders in that area, right?
You can't be a leader without conviction.
It's not an option. And we're not saying everybody has to be a scholar. Everybody has to be perfect. We're not saying that by any means. We're not any of those things. Hunger and passion for the original intent and the truth and his way of life is what has put us in a position to lead a family. Nothing else. Right? And we're not putting any demand on any of you that we haven't experienced. And it's literally the hunger and the passion for his way of life that has led all of us to this point. Right? And that's what will lead your guys' households to continue to secure that legacy. So,
and one way of doing that is making all of this personal. So while he's talking about how a family did this, remember, if we are the temple, then what is it every year that you have the ability to honor, to say what leadership that has been outside my culture has desecrated my convictions? What has told me what to do and what not to do that was not what I was supposed to do? And what then... Does that make sense? Like, what Roman Empire is in me that is telling me that I can't do what Yahweh said to do?
Yeah.
Let me just make it real simple.
Yeah.
Yahweh says that you're supposed to raise people from the dead. What system said, I'm going to mock that and say, nah, that ain't for today, or no, you can't do that. And so that system is basically mocking that and saying you don't have access to that. So then every year, what Hanukkah is revolting against the system that says that that's what I'm supposed to abide by, getting rid of that, cleaning out the temple of anything that has that in there, and then reestablishing what Yahweh said. Yeah. So in that one rededication, I will raise people from the dead. I do operate in signs, wonders, and miracles. You know, those have, I have access to the, you know, to every, all of that gets reestablished, and then it's the miracle of the light that continues to shine in that dedication, that 8 days, which is the number of completeness, it's covenant and it's separation, that for 8 days I'm going to dedicate myself and I'm going to proclaim that over my life. That is what Hanukkah is about every year.
Yeah, and I think it's good to acknowledge things like that and how deep the desecration goes. So a lot of the criticism will come from, if we strictly say we are not engaging in Christmas, we're not buying Christmas presents, we're not doing any of that thing, because it's very easy to say it doesn't matter, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Everything we learned about, no, it doesn't matter. How that's a loophole to not have to really stand on your conviction or be passionate about it or be a leader in that way in the face of the overwhelming pressure to just tolerate. When you think about that temple and the details of how Yahweh wanted you to build the temple and maintain the temple, his level of detail and how much it matters, it doesn't allow for you to just bring in whatever kind of other man-made tradition. You can't do that.
Yeah.
Right? And so really, how deep does this go when you think about our history and why we celebrate this and how you should position yourself or respond when, you know, people say, like my parents were just telling me, they went to some Bible study and some of the people had, they were excited about Hanukkah and Christmas lining up on the same day and they were wearing sweaters that said like Chrismukkah or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's cute, you know, and that's nice or whatever. But when you think about it in terms of this context, that's like trying to bring man-made traditions into the temple,
it's
and
like
you're
putting
just
a
desecrating
tree next
it.
To the menorah and saying, this will work.
You're desecrating it, just like you're just giving into the what the outside world is trying to force us to do. And so that's why, that's the heart of why we're honoring our ancestors and we're securing and safeguarding that tradition, because we don't want to be the ones that partner in desecrating the temple, right? Because that's what it comes down to.
And here's what I want to kind of connect, just a couple things real quick before Derek gets into some stuff. We don't know a lot in the scriptures about Hanukkah. There's not a lot there, but what we do know is that Yeshua honored it. It's called the Festival of Lights. It's also Hanukkah, but it is the Feast of Lights, the dedication of lights. And we see that Yeshua honored it. So he was a Jew, raised in a Jewish home, and that's what they did. So in that culture and in that time, he knew the Maccabees. He knew the story. When Yeshua came along, there wasn't a canonized Bible, right? You had the Tanakh, you had the Torah, and you had the prophets, and those were definitely read in the synagogue. But I don't, meaning like only the five books and the prophets, but that didn't have anything to do with anything else that they were taught in the culture. So he was aware of the Maccabees, knew what it was that they stood for him to get there, because it was their bloodline, right? The tribe of Judah. So, I mean, it was them carrying that on. Now, I want to explain how close this was. When they took over from, what's his name? Antioch. When they took over, they reigned, that dynasty reigned, up until Herod. So they reigned all the way until Herod took over. When Herod took over, now you see Yeshua come on the scene. So he, wow. I mean, it was that close in those silent years of what it was that he was honoring. So it is not an appointed feast. It is not in the Torah, because it hadn't happened yet. It is not something that you are dedicated, you know, for the rest of your life, you're supposed to honor Passover, the seven feasts. Hanukkah is not, you do not have to honor Hanukkah. There's nothing in the Torah that says that this is something that you're supposed to do. But what's interesting is that as a Jew, Yeshua was raised in a culture, and I see what I see my father doing.
Right.
And what he did was he honored those things. And so he was at the synagogue during the Feast of Dedication, or the Festival of Lights. But there's not, we don't know anything else. Mm-hmm. Other than going to the synagogue and reading, you know, reading the Torah. So we don't necessarily know. We do know, though, that he was confronted right after he went there. So that's just kind of an interesting thing, that when you do honor this, confrontation usually comes, because that's what happened in the scripture. Here's another thing I want to tie together. You can also see the culture of Judah and the tribe of Judah. That's why I believe part of it they missed. They were looking for a Judah.
I want to
apply. We have to pendulum swing out of the pansy movement. That's why we're raising warriors. But don't misplace, well, I'm a warrior, and forget, go low, humble. Yeah. Because when the king of the Jews came, he died. That's why they missed it, because they're like, we're warriors, and we rebel, and we don't do, like, take over the Roman Empire. And Yeshua didn't do that. That's why we get both, because he honored Judah Maccabee. But he didn't do exactly what he did, because he did what his father told him to do. That's why it's hard when people say, well, you're just trying to be Jewish. No. But I'm going to honor that heritage, and I'm going to walk with those characteristics. But I also have a Messiah that told us how we're to walk. Right? Yeah. And it's not in opposition. Because then some people would be like, well, yeah, but he wasn't in opposition. He honored what Judah Maccabee did, because he went to the Festival of Lights. So it's not like he's against being a warrior. He was flipping tables and calling people some. I mean, he is a warrior. But at the same time, there's, you know, I just want to make sure we rightly apply that warrior spirit in the midst of what the Messiah carried, and they're not in opposition. That's why it's so interesting for us to teach multidimensional, because you've got, you know, don't be a doormat, but then you're supposed to go low. That's what wisdom does. Because I'm not going to give a 5-point sermon and put you in a box and say, this is just the way you're supposed to operate. Right. That's not how this works. You have to have wisdom, discernment. You have to know how to flow. You've got, because he had all the characteristics. He was loving. He was a warrior. And he, you know, so anyways, just wanted to.
Well, think of the aspect of Yeshua following orders. Like, he did not detract from the orders that his father gave him.
And the orders were different for Judah Maccabee than it was his, but he still had the conviction all the way to death. It's the same spirit. It just looks different. So this is what happens. When you don't have wisdom, you don't have the spirit, you try to look the same as something else, and then you're way off base. But because they both had the same spirit, they were going to die for a conviction. It just looked different. So then that's why you can't apply one story and be like, well, then that's just the way I'm. You have to have that wisdom and discernment, because it's the same spirit, but it's going to look different. We've talked about that before, how you have two people look exactly the same. The original, where it came out of the original, is what matters. So.
That's good. It's just kind of crazy to think all that heritage. I mean, the dreidels, the menorah, they all have significance in the context of this story. And now we get together and celebrate and wear pajamas with, you know, cute pajamas that have these things on them, you know, and it has this tendency to be dismissive. Obviously, we're not doing that. But in the general, there's this dismissiveness of, it's just like, it's just a replacement of Christmas for the Jews. The Jews do this, and, you know, it's far from that. But I want to have Derek.
They fought for my freedom to have cute pajamas.
Right. So Derek's going to build on that by talking about archery and some of those dynamics, and then we'll get back to it.
All right. So some of the first part, archery, like any other skill set, is one of those, like, it's a skill set that not practiced often can deteriorate. Just like whether you're shooting firearms, whether you're engage in any martial art, left neglected, it's something that does begin to deteriorate, therefore it needs to be maintained when you do it. So the beginning portions of it are so fundamental to how you position yourself. Obviously, this completely aligns with, like, just our spiritual walk in general. All the way down to, like, the first portion of archery is obviously knowing your target, because of the need to position yourself correctly. And typically, like you can see something, engage something standing like this, but in archery you will actually aim the direction that you're shooting, and so the stance is kind of vital to however you're doing it. If you're not, if you're holding the bow and you pull back, like you can't get a full draw. When you're sideways, your body will let you reach an anchor point. One thing about archery is repeatable anchor points are vital. So it's something that the first time everything feels awkward. Like it's just like the first time doing jiu-jitsu felt awkward. Anything you do that's new is awkward. And so knowing the foundations are vital. A lot of times people will grab a bow and it's very tempting to grip really tight. And the problem with the tight grip is it manipulates the direction of the bow because you can't grab it the same way every time. It'll twist the bow. And so oftentimes you grab and then there has to be an element of relaxing it in your hand. Like oftentimes when I get my bow all the way back, like I'll grip to pull back and then I let my hands go to where it's just sitting in the cradle of your thumb and your pointer. And then I lightly set it. And that's just so that you don't twist it or manipulate it. Because it'll literally send an arrow that way or that way versus the direction you're trying to shoot. And it's important to, in the middle of, like as you pull a bow back, the resistance increases the entire time that you're coming back on a traditional bow. And with the increased resistance, it's natural, just like in jiu-jitsu, if you start fighting, you tense up. And there's a moment you got to remember to breathe. You got to like be calm in chaos. And in archery, it's the same thing. The more resistance or the more chaos is coming, you have to remember to pause to relax because you will manipulate a shot not where you're trying to send it. Anchor point is something I mentioned, meaning a repeatable, I almost see it like a testimony. There's things that have worked in our life that you make the same every time. When you pull a bow back, you want something to touch your chin. I pick the corner of my jawline and I'll anchor, and I always know when I feel this in there, that's correct. I oftentimes feel the string touching my face, or I'll feel a fletching touching my cheek. And those are anchor points. So if I pull this way and I don't feel it, I rest into the position that I can feel repeatable anchor points. Because sending an arrow, like just sending it wildly is easy. But sending it somewhere is such a, it's a mind, spirit, body, like it's a situation that you have to be focused. Oftentimes, shooting can be frustrating, just like overcoming things can be frustrating, or trying to, you know, achieve the impossible is obviously frustrating. And not allowing, like, arrows that you sent downrange, mentally don't let them affect the new ones in your quiver that haven't even been launched yet. Like, being able to, every time, my stance is right, my form is right, I've released in the chaos, like I'm focused enough to be calm. And then the release of it, this is a traditional bow that is much harder to shoot, only because there's no sights. There's nothing to aim with. It's something that you point, and you are able to just focus on the target, and it has to be an element of muscle memory. Like, I know that's further away, so I know my body's naturally holding it higher for it to come down onto this target. Newer bows, which when we shoot, a lot of it will be with newer bows. These have pins, different sights. These are for different ranges. So when you have it anchored, when this is tight to me, this peep becomes visible. There's a hole there that will sit by my eye. That aligns with one of these dots. I don't know if you guys can see all the dots in there. It aligns with one of those. The temptation with these newer bows is to focus on the dot. And typically, focusing on where you want your arrow to land helps you have a follow-through. Because when you let go of a bow, it's easy to, when you have a victory, just let down or drop your guard or whatever. And in an arrow, once you release, this arrow's still flying through the rest. And if you give up too soon or relax too soon, you come completely off target. Your follow through will drop it into the ground.
Mm-hmm. While it's flying through rest.
Rest.
So rest doesn't mean. It means it's flying through.
So it's an element of being able to stay focused after the release, mm-hmm. because that's what matters about making contact. So there's a lot to archery that will tie, honestly, to every, I mean, just like any martial art, I swear, everything violent, I think, requires like strength and chaos, focus, correct positioning, correct stance, like all those things are key to anything you engage in. Therefore, like spiritually, it's not going to just be void of all of it. Like there's the aspects of follow through, there's the aspects of focus and what we're focusing on and what to focus on, like whether to shoot at something. Timing is a huge thing, but these are some of just the basics. When we get to shoot, you will feel for today, like a portion of canceling today is with the how cold it is and how windy it is. The first time can be so frustrating, it's difficult to re-engage. And being something that I would want a good experience for people, being able to not be frozen, not shaking, not it's already hard enough when you're holding resistance back and trying to remember all these things that are foreign, trying to remember to loosen your grip and allow things to work correctly. It's new. And so, I mean, that's a part of why we didn't do it today, but there will be a time that we will get to do it. And one other thing is within different arrows, so the way an arrow knocks, you have your string, but see how there's one color, there's always an odd fletching. And if this is positioned the wrong way, when it comes through the rest, it'll bump it. And it begins to like fishtail through the air. And so having the beginning, before you even ever pull back, mm-hmm. having it positioned correctly mm-hmm. matters, and it depends on the bow. This other style bow has a odd fletching that points out to the side instead of down or up. And those things matter when you're shooting, but this is all something we'll get to experience it, we'll get to feel it. But there's, yeah, this one's actual feathers, and it's just so they're made to crush as they go past. The older bows, because there's a shelf, literally a shelf, one of the fletchings has to be, pliable, that it can go past and not kick the arrow up. Newer rests have contact points that touch the arrow and allow the fletchings to go through kind of like unrestricted, so it's a little different. But, yeah, there is a lot of similarity, so. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm thinking about the teaching going back to Joseph about being a master archer. You know, and talking about like the elements and like he's talking about like the wind. So it's like hard enough, but then being able to do it at the end of the day, this is why we practice in family. Yeah. That's this is that lesson that we get on a Friday night where it's like, we're showing the bow, we're showing the arrow, but when it comes time to actually shooting, you also have to learn how to do it in the midst of the elements. You don't get to say, well, it's windy.
You have to,
that's why you've got to, you know, practice and all of that. So thinking about that master archer and being able to handle the elements and then also I think a long time ago we had released like that word of why, like if, like what, like if you just went like this, ding, you're not going to get very far, especially if the target's way over there. So there's this aspect of your, meaning like as parents, there's a scripture that says that you're like the arrows in a quiver. So yes, you're an archer. You can be the bow. You can be the string. You could be the arrow.
Yeah.
So it's like sometimes as an arrow, when Yahweh's the one that's like pulling you, you're like, but I want to get over there.
Yeah.
I thought I was supposed to be over there. I want to be over there. And he's like, you to get there, I need you to go. I gotta pull you way back. You know, parenting within the funnel. I gotta pull back these freedom. You know what I mean? You're like, why are we going backwards?
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm just setting you up, right? So, or if you're the one that's like, okay, fine, I'll let you make me go backwards, but I'm gonna be, what did you call the feathers?
Oh, fletching.
I'll be a fletching that's backwards. So then you're like, I'm gonna do it this way, and then when he goes and releases you, you're like, burr, 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 and then you're like, you should have been positioned properly in the going backwards. You know what I mean? because we all want to fight against the going backwards, you know? But it's like, even be positioned properly in the backwards, or else you're going to be flying through the air, like, and definitely not hit the target. So there's so much in all of that. It's going to be awesome.
Powerful stuff.
So
now we have a gift we want to give everybody that we feel will just kind of solidify or establish that, or stir further that hunger and passion.
And one more thing. He said anything with violence. What, say that again? Anything with violence, I think, needs follow through?
Yeah.
Okay. There's this scripture, Matthew 11:12. I'm going to amplify it for you. And from the days of John the Baptist until the present time, today, the kingdom of heaven has endured violent assault, and violent men seize it by force. As a precious prize, a share in the heavenly kingdom is sought with most ardent zeal and intense exertion.
Come on now.
So, we're not just talking about, like, martial arts happens to be violent. The things of the kingdom are violent, so it requires follow through, requires training and follow through.
What was that verse?
Matthew 11:12.